1. 28 squeeze packs of peanut and almond butter. Jun spent 3 weeks holed up in Madrid. If she was going to Marius, she needed to muddy her trail and let it get a little cold. After Singapore, she took a flight to Manila, then a second onward, then another, then another. Between two of those, she pulled her alternate passport in the name Ho Sara from the bottom of her rucksack. She'd never traveled on a false passport before. It had been a stunt for her video audience to get one made, and somewhere between a private pleasure and paranoia to keep it. A comfort blanket for former refugees. She hadn't known whether it would work until, in an airport between here and there, it suddenly seemed less dangerous to try than not to. In Manila, she withdrew all the cash she could using 8 different ATMs. In a mini-mart in the airport, she bought ramen noodles. She set her automated assistant to cancel her upcoming engagements on the grounds of, she considered, exposure to leprosy. People would believe that, and no one would try to persuade her to come. On the flight out of Manila, she took the battery out of her cell phone and snapped her SIM card in half. 35,000 feet in the air, she disabled all wireless communications on her laptop, her Anvil thin screen, her Medlar torque, and every other smart device she owned. In Ankara, she changed all her cash into euros using Ho Sara's passport and dumped the SIM down a toilet. In Skopje, she had a 16-hour wait for her next flight and bleached her hair, because why not, in the toilets. In Madrid, because she had no connections to Madrid, because, as far as she was aware, she knew no one here, she rode a bus into town, got off, and started walking when the bus passed through an area with peeling paint and faded signs. On a street of cheap flop houses and discount electronic stores, she checked into the first grimy hotel she could find, the sticky sheets reassuring her that there were probably no smart devices tracking her face. If a government was following her, this wouldn't be enough. If she'd somehow gotten into the bad books of Fantel or Medlar or another huge tech company, say by ending up with their experimental proprietary software on her phone, it might be enough. And if it was just a mentally ill religious fundamentalist, or even a few mentally ill religious fundamentalists, this level of care should do it. She paid cash for 3 weeks in advance. In a room with striped orange and red curtains drawn and a pink bobbled lampshade, she went through her bags to learn, when it came to it, whether she actually had enough to survive on, or whether her whole life had been an embarrassing pretense. She had 16 packets of ramen noodles, 1 large bag of trail mix, 1 large packet of something called Bomba Snack, which had been pulverized to a fine peanut-flavored powder at the bottom of her backpack, 8 different colored survival gel pouches she'd picked up at a trade show, each claiming to contain a full day's worth of nutrition in an appealing flavor. The flavors, she discovered, were all the same. Lime, with a faint but noticeable aftertaste of toilet cleaner. 12 sticks of beef jerky, 6 packets of protein powder, 28 squeeze packs of peanut and almond butter, 90 multivitamin tablets, an apple. She had, in addition, an anthology of selected great works of English literature and first 1,000 words and basic grammar of the world's 20 most spoken languages printed on a thin, treated paper that would, in a pinch, serve as either toilet paper or fire starters, not that she needed either. A book of cryptic crosswords, a skill she'd admired since arriving in the UK but had never learned, holding it deliberately in reserve in her mind for after the apocalypse. A small wind-up radio, 8 pencils, 5 ballpoint pens, and a small yellow children's exercise book. That was okay. Enough here to get along with while not turning on any of her devices. Still the dork with the survival habit. Still, unlike the world, making sense. She ate the apple first. It would never be better nutritionally than it was today. It was crisp and juicy, and she experienced it very urgently. The world pressing in on her senses, a ritual for the start of a lockdown. These were bad days, but they were also simple ones. She remembered the months in her early teenage life in Hong Kong, when her mom was dying and she didn't leave the house, or when she and her dad were in the offshore refugee camp waiting for their interviews to get into the UK. The amount of mental effort and dedication it took to just keep holding on to a routine that spooled out into the future. She ran on the spot, did jumping jacks and push-ups and squats. She remembered her dad trying to get her interested in calisthenics and how stupid the old man had looked, twisting his body to the left, 2, 3, right, 2, 3, and how much she'd love to have him here now. The boredom and the fear felt, in their way, familiar and safe. She wanted to log on to the internet to find out what the fuck had happened in Singapore. She constantly had the urge to call her dad or her ex or any one of a dozen friends. The urge rose up and passed away, again and again. Every time it came back, she thought of the shot perfectly aimed through the center of the Valentine Fox bin. She needed to give this some time. She slept a lot. She watched Spanish television and CNN and listened to the radio. No one mentioned a shooter in a Singaporean mall, or an unexplained dead body, or an international manhunt for a wanted criminal paramagnetic salt snow murderer. Her Spanish improved through sheer desperation for information. She learned how to do cryptic crosswords. After 13 days in the room, she ventured down the corridor to the vending machine at midnight with a fistful of euro coins. She couldn't stop shaking, standing at the machine, trying to look like anyone else choosing a candy bar. When the stairwell doors banged open, she flinched. A young, straight couple kissing as they walked didn't look her way. Back in the room, she ate the candy bars one after another. Halfway through a sticky sweet Spanish almond joy knockoff, she couldn't keep the pieces in her mouth, spat them into her hand, and cried. After 20 days, she packed up her bags and left the hotel at 5 a.m. It was the start of July now, and the sky was bright. A good time of year for some hard travel. She found a convenience store where she bought 3 cheap dumb phones in blister packs and 3 local SIM cards. She took the first subway train of the day to Chamartín Clara Campo Amor station. There was one man on the train, a construction worker in boots and overalls still splattered with yesterday's dust and paint. She sat on the platform. 5 small blackbirds pecked at a bag of chips. The next train going northeast across the expanded Schengen area, the largest border check-free area in the world, pulled out of the station at 8:43 a.m. This part was complicated, but easy in its way. Trains across Europe, one after another, avoiding Switzerland and any of the smaller territories not part of Schengen. Hoodie pulled down low, 3 pieces of clear holographic reflective duct tape strategically placed on her face to avoid the cameras and the recognition programs in the richer and more authoritarian parts of the continent. In person, it just looked like she had some band-aids covering a couple of cuts. On the cameras, it had come up as strange black shapes that would confuse the algorithm. Chun imagined who could be watching her. The government of Singapore, and a warrant for arrest and extradition. The staff of Fantail, Anvil, and or Medlar, all of which had supplied technological infrastructure to most governments and public services in Europe. A small but extremely determined band of online fundamentalists who might have a friend or a sympathizer in any shop, any cafe, any ticket booth. She arrived late at night in every station, just before the ticket offices closed. She paid in cash. Where possible, she slept on the train. Her bones ached with exhaustion. Her final journey was the night train from Budapest to Bucharest, not a service that had received the sort of investment Anvil had poured into expensive automated cars and Lenk Skatlish had put into a failed space elevator. Chun shared the rattling sleeper compartment with a Romanian woman who traveled with a bottle of plum brandy and smelled of wet wool. The woman fell asleep just after midnight and let out a continual series of ripe and marshy farts. Redolent, Jun felt, of the fields of her homeland, or at least of their livestock. Even with the window cracked open and the cold air tumbling onto her face as the train clacked out the miles, it was impossible to sleep. Chun lay in the dark and thought of her mother. She had a total of 38 photographs of her, the one where she was holding one-year-old Chun on her lap in the small courtyard garden of their apartment building was her favorite. It was a Medlar Move photo, and Chun's mother turned her head at some distant noise, and then, at a gurgle from Chun, turned her head back. The love in the gaze between Chun and her mother in that moment was so intense and pure that Chun could feel it still. She could not access that photo now. Like the rest of her most important possessions, it was online. She wished she'd thought to turn it into a corny trinket, a keyring or a pendant or some shit. It was no use now to be too cool for feelings. Her mother had died from cancer when Chun was 14. She had not wanted to go. That was the thing Chun remembered most of that last year. Her mother had not been reconciled to dying. She had not been peaceful. She had clutched Chun's hand and tried to tell her all the things she might need to know for an entire happy life, disordered and increasingly confused. The thing she'd never said was the greatest lesson Chun had taken from all that. You could die while wanting desperately to live, with many important things left unfinished. The future would come while you were looking the other way. And there were so many things that could kill you. Chun's mother had made her father promise that they would leave for the UK. There had been riots and demonstrations against encroachments by the PRC in Hong Kong. Chun had been young then, not even old enough to join the street protests and the gas mask-wearing students facing the police and the tear gas. She wouldn't have done it if she'd been older anyway. Her mother was weaker day by day. Chun had read online about teenage rebellion and had decided, quite coherently, as if this was a thing a person could choose, that her own rebellion would have to wait until her mother was well. Nonetheless, the protests were impossible to ignore. Chun's mother watched with her as young people holding rainbow flags shouted anti-government slogans in unison. She looked at her daughter appraisingly, understanding things about her that Chun hadn't fully grasped yet. She squeezed Chun's hand. She said, "Dad will apply for the visas." But because of her mother's cancer, her father hadn't filed the forms on time. There were visas for Hong Kong citizens to go live in the UK, but her mother couldn't move country, and so, in those months when every day felt like it could be the end, they couldn't think of the future. After she died, it was too late to do the thing smoothly. It wasn't as if they hadn't known the deadlines, after all. So that was one of the million ways you end up in an offshore British refugee camp. Chun had read online in the days after the demolition conference about what had happened to Martha's mother, or at least the rumors of what had happened to her. Martha's mother had left Enoch soon after Enoch set up his compound and started preaching about the preparation for the end of days. She had gone in the night. She had left her 7-year-old daughter with Enoch for whatever life he would give her, and she had found a new partner in Portland, and not shown much interest in trying to get her daughter back over the following 5 years until she had crossed the street without looking and had been hit by a Frito-Lay truck and died. The future would come and kill you while you were looking the other way. She wondered whether she and Martha had known this about each other somehow, in the first glance. Maybe that's what love was, or sudden pointed lust, or attraction, or whatever Chun had felt in that first moment. Just a recognition that this person would be able to understand the worst thing that had happened in your life. And if they'd known that about each other, how had they known? Maybe women whose mothers had died when they were very young could tell this about each other by a certain way of holding their shoulders, by their blink rate, by the clothes they wore. Chun had sometimes felt that she had a sort of twisted wire between her organs, holding her up, Where others had their soft and tense tissue, she had something made of metal. Maybe that was what she and Martha had heard in each other, the wire in their words. As the miles ticked off beneath her, counted on the cross grid of the railway sleepers, she wondered whether it would be possible to program a surveillance system to look for these signs, whatever they were. A markup language for humans. Something showing that whatever happened, however much future had already been taken away from you, you would find a way to survive.